Today on Against the Grain, the left has a long history of predicting the decline of U.S. capitalism and empire. Some argue that Trump is a symptom of that decline, a strongman chosen by capital to set things right, and that the ill health of U.S. capitalism is paralleled by the decline of the dollar.
Those crises, environmental, social, political, are outcomes of the strength of capital. They are the direct result of the inability of the political system to contain and manage the contradictions of capitalist triumph, of capitalist strength.
Political economist Stephen Marr argues that U.S. capitalism is robust, to the detriment of most of us. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. We often hear on the left that the global financial crisis of 2008 ushered in the beginning, or accelerated, the decline of U.S. capitalism. Some argue that the U.S. economy is now just driven by financial froth, that the real basis of economic production, of manufactured things, not speculative assets, has been hollowed out. Joining us to make sense of these claims is Stephen Marr, co-editor of the Socialist Register and author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance. Steve, do you think that these many diagnoses of U.S. capitalism's decline have merit?
No, I don't, frankly. And it's interesting because, you know, now it's been quite some time that these people who have been claiming that, you know, financialization is going to bring about the demise of the competitiveness of American industry, you know, they've been saying this for a long time. And so, you know, one wonders when this is going to occur. I mean, after the 2008 crisis, obviously 2008 was a huge, very significant crisis, the worst crisis since the 1930s, and therefore one of the worst crises in the history of capitalism. But the American economy recovered very, you know, substantially from that crisis relatively quickly, to the point that by 2020, profits were at historic highs. After 2021, after COVID, those historic highs were even more historic and more high. You know, productivity growth did come back a bit more slowly, but by the 2010s, it was equal to where it had been, you know, two decades earlier. So the economy is performing quite well. And I think not in spite of, but because of the way that financialization has been restructured since the 2008 crisis. In terms of the tech companies, I mean, it's really striking. Some voices on the left have basically moved on from or extended their earlier critique of so-called fictitious capital, that is to say, their term for finance, as being parasitic and draining rent from the quote-unquote real economy, to attribute similar dynamics to the tech companies. And that, to me, really strains credulity. I mean, if one can kind of casually or superficially accept the plausibility of those arguments when they're applied to, you know, the financial sector, it's really hard to do so in relation to the tech firms, which are, you know, undertaking historic, you know, very large scale technological innovation that is enhancing and extending the competitiveness of American capitalism. You know, we see very high levels of investment, very high levels of R&D spending, very rapid technological change, and they're revolutionizing entire industries. So it's interesting to point to the most dynamic and innovative sector of the economy as some kind of raunchy or parasite. It doesn't really fit just on the face of it. And I think if you look more deeply, it really doesn't make much sense, especially with regard to the monopoly claims. I mean, the dynamics whereby the tech companies have developed since 2008 bear no resemblance to what one would predict if they were to be monopolies. You know, technological stagnation, surplus capacity, you know, inflated prices. Those are the kind of dynamics that one associates with monopolization. And yet, in the case of the tech companies, we see rapid technological change, high investment, and intense price competition. And that has had an impact across the entire U.S. economy, been really the foundation of its ongoing position as the most dynamic and competitive economy in the world.
And I'm sure we'll return to this, but there are, of course, many critics, including people who come out of tech, who see that a lot of tech has been invested into AI, which many people argue is kind of overhyped, oversold, has led to a bubble. Do you think that there is an element of froth within tech itself, or should we situate that within a larger trajectory of tech expansion and growth?
Yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible that there will be a market correction or a devaluation of the tech stocks. I mean, but that, as you're implying in your question, you know, that is the typical dynamics of technological development and capitalism. I mean, whether we're talking about the railroads or you know, any other major technological development, the process of technological change and the way that technological change interacts with, you know, investment and finance is very much borne out by the fact that we could see a bit of overvaluation, and then of course the destruction of those values, followed by, you know, the concentration of those markets around a few leading firms to form a new market structure. That's entirely consistent with the way that technological development happens in capitalism. So if some firms go belly up, you know, that may be the case. But the idea that AI as such, or these new technologies that have emerged in the past couple of years around AI, are going to just simply be erased, I think that's wishful thinking on the part of many people.
So what you're arguing then is that although many on the left see U.S. capitalism in decline, and of course, you're arguing that all these different indicators since the global financial crisis actually point to the health of the capitalist system. But then I think many listeners would say, well, but wait a minute, I feel like I'm living in a society in crisis. So where is the crisis as you see it in our moment?
Yeah, I mean, this is really the key question, right? It's how can we have, when we look around ourselves and we see, you know, the extreme levels of social crisis that have been mounting over the course of, you know, of the entire neoliberal period, and certainly continued since 2008, in some ways accelerated, the ecological crisis, the political crisis, the instability in the political institutions that govern American and global capitalism. How can we square that with the ongoing strength of capital? And what I would argue is that, in fact, those crises, environmental, social, political, are outcomes of the strength of capital. They are the direct result of the inability of the political system to contain and manage the contradictions of capitalist triumph, of capitalist strength. And I think what's important to keep in mind is that what's good for capital is not necessarily good for people, and it's not necessarily good for the environment. As a matter of fact, a strong and healthy and well-functioning or properly functioning capitalism is harmful for the working class. It's predicated on disciplining the working class, producing unemployment, you know, pushing down on wages, intensifying competitiveness to maximize profits and maximize efficiency, and therefore also to push aside and to tend to roll back environmental regulations and labor protections. And so it is entirely possible that a healthy capitalism is one that is harmful for the majority of the population, and ecocidal even in the case of the environment. So I think one of the key lessons actually of Marx, which I think people don't pay enough attention to, is that capitalism systematically tends to produce the conditions that make it difficult to govern. It systematically undermines its own political stability by generating inequality, by creating social conflict in ways that are very difficult to contain and legitimate by an established set of political institutions that we refer to as the state. The state, one of its main functions is to legitimate capitalism, to take a system that is based on exploitation, that is based on huge inequalities in economic income and wealth, as well as inequalities in political power, and to legitimate that by presenting an appearance of, you know, social cohesion and popular consent for that system. And yet that becomes hard to achieve in a context in which those inequalities, precisely because of the strength of capital, grow. The levels of exploitation increase. The amount of environmental destruction accelerates. All these things that we know systematically result from capital accumulation at the same time make capitalism very, very hard to govern and to legitimate by a state that is, you know, somewhat democratic, but hardly democratic enough, to say the least. And so what that means is that within the structure of this formally democratic state, there is the possibility for a populist backlash. And in the context in which there's not a left, that populist backlash very often may take the form of of the far right, which is precisely what we're seeing. A far right that may be willing to make entreaties to capital and may be attempting to win capital over to its political agenda, but one which nevertheless is not simply the creature or the creation of capital.
Right. So then, as you're arguing, if we can't attribute Trump's rise, because obviously that is what ultimately we're talking about here, as a response by part of the capitalist class or the state to the decline of US capitalism, which is the argument that is often made, then, to what should we attribute this rise?
Yeah, that's a really important question because you're right that much of the left has seemingly, come around to the analysis that Trump is actually just a kind of instrument of capital, that he's a straightforward extension of the decline of capitalism in the United States. And so you have capitalist decline, and then you have the unproblematic arrival of Trump as a vehicle to whereby the capitalist class can attempt to reverse the decline of the American empire and American capitalism by doing all this crazy stuff he's doing around the world. And I think this has several problems. The first is just that it's empirically incorrect. I mean, the majority of the capitalist class supported Harris, not Trump. When she announced that she was going to be the Democratic nominee after Biden stepped aside, she became the fastest ever to raise $1 billion just 80 days after she announced that she was the nominee. Meanwhile, Trump, I think, has been seen widely as being a threat to the stability and peace of neoliberal globalization. He ran on a populist backlash against the global order of free trade and free capital mobility that had an enormous social cost, but which was extremely profitable for capital. And so the instability and chaos that he brings risks disrupting that order that was entirely profitable and beneficial for capital. So they would vastly prefer Harris or the Democratic Party as a kind of neoliberal standard bearer to maintain things as they are, to maintain the status quo, and to have that go smoothly. The unfortunate piece for them is that Harris was unable to win because the consensus around the continuation of that policy was simply not there. So if they could have had their way, they would have had Harris win, as indicated by their extensive financial and other support for her. Really, these accounts that you're mentioning, they rest on two different kind of theoretical foundations. The first is economism, which is to say that all politics can be explained as the extension of economic processes. Whatever happens in politics can just be reduced to something economic, and there's no real space for an autonomous political sphere, or as we would say in Marxist state theory, relatively autonomous political sphere, wherein different social forces clash and contest one another for what kind of political relations and so on that are going to characterize the current moment. The other is instrumentalism, whereby the capitalist class just kind of directly and unproblematically instrumentalizes the state. It controls the state directly. So particular capitalists basically tell the state what to do, and it does it. It implements their agenda. And so when you combine these two things, what you get is economism, capitalist decline, therefore instrumentalism. The state is then taken control of by leading capitalist sectors and manipulated to do what they need it to do in order to reverse that decline. But unfortunately, this is far from how capitalist states actually work, as has been established by Marxist state theorists like Nikos Poulantzas and Ralph Miliband. Capitalist states are relatively autonomous from capital. They are not directly under the control of particular capitalists. They organize the power of the capitalist class, which requires them to be at something of a distance from the direct impact, direct influence of particular firms in order to build a broad kind of what Nikos Poulantzas called unstable equilibrium of compromise. And so that requires that they, in order to be functional, they have to have some space from capital. And it also creates an opening for popular interventions. Now, those interventions can take various forms. They can take the form of, socialist or social democratic parties and political forces. They can also take the form of far right political forces that capital may be more inclined toward than the left version in the event that they have to choose between the two, but which nevertheless is not simply a directly a creature of capital. So in order to understand what's happening with Trump, we actually have to recognize that what's really going on here is a specifically political crisis, a crisis that arises precisely from the fact that capital does not control the state, and that it was not able to simply implement its chosen agenda and put in power its chosen political figure. And it's therein that lies the source of the political crisis and the ongoing chaos and significant damage, actually, that's been done to the American empire around the world by virtue of the election of Trump.
Political economist Stephen Marr is my guest. He is the co-author of The Fall and Rise of American Finance, From J.P. Morgan to BlackRock. This is Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Just staying for a few minutes more with this notion of decline, because it's a very powerful one on the left. It can take on the role of sort of wishful thinking. And one place where, beyond what you've been describing so far, where one sees this argument is around not just U.S. capitalism, you know, thought of, say, domestically, but the U.S. empire. And there have been predictions for many decades of the U.S. empire in decline. And there has been, I think, a very intense focus on the state, the health of U.S. empire recently with the U.S. and Israel's attack on Iran and how that attack might remake the order, the geopolitical order, with a focus on the question of the U.S. dollar. So you have argued elsewhere that the United States plays the central role within global capitalism, partly because of the importance of the U.S. dollar. And since the 1970s, petroleum has been priced and traded in dollars. So if you're a country that wants to buy petroleum, you must have dollars. And well before the start of the attack on Iran, there have been prognostications that the reign of the dollar is at an end and that countries will abandon using the dollar for pricing petroleum. And this may also indicate the rise of China. Can you tell us why you question such predictions?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important question. And I think there are many reasons, I think, why that assessment is off the mark. The first is that, well, let's say, for example, that oil starts to be priced in renminbi or yuan instead of U.S. dollars. Well, the first outcome of that will be that that currency, the Chinese currency, will appreciate. And when the Chinese currency appreciates, that means that their exports are going to become more expensive and less competitive. So even from the point of view of China's own interests, it's hard to see how they would have an interest in having oil priced in their currency. But more fundamentally, I mean, there's a deep misunderstanding, I think, of petrodollar system, what its foundations, in fact, are. It's not that the dollar is world money because oil is priced in dollars. It's that oil is priced in dollars because the dollar is world money. So the stability of the U.S. dollar as the center of the global monetary system means that trading oil in dollars makes sense. It's least susceptible to sudden fluctuations in its value, and it's obviously going to be the most stable way of measuring and exchanging value in the world market. And the secondary reason why oil is priced in dollars is because of the geopolitical role of the U.S. in securing the flow of oil globally, right? No other state has taken the responsibility for undertaking military and other actions to sustain the flow of oil internationally. And so that means that it makes sense to price oil in dollars. The other issue with seeing the dollar as being somehow threatened by, you know, oftentimes people point to the BRICS as potentially developing an alternative.
And BRICS, of course, are the middle income countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa.
The BRICS are, you know, they have no central bank. They are politically incoherent. There's no real basis on which the BRICS could formulate a common currency that could serve as world money. They're very, very, very far from being able to do so. But you can look at the fact that U.S. dollar reserve holdings, you know, the willingness of other states to hold U.S. dollars as foreign exchange, has basically been at around 60% since 1970. So you can see small fluctuations up or down here and there, and people will make a lot of every dip in foreign exchange holdings of U.S. dollars, but they've been pretty consistent at about 60% since 1970. But more important than official state holdings of U.S. dollars are the private holdings. If China is running a trade deficit in U.S. dollars, and then it decides to recycle some of those dollars into euros, that doesn't tell us much at all, right? If that's just 2% of U.S. dollar holdings. Private holdings of U.S. dollars are much, much, much larger. And when we look at the role of the dollar in the global financial system, particularly repo markets that are the center of the current credit system, the use of dollars in those markets is overwhelmingly predominant. So there's a range of reasons why the dollar remains strong, and those reasons have not that much to do with the fact that oil is priced in dollars. If anything, oil being priced in dollars is an effect rather than a cause of the dollar strength.
Even if those things are all true, is it the case, and you've been arguing that we need to understand the centrality of the United States as a key power in managing global capitalism, a role it has played since at least following World War II. So even if that is the case, could it also not be that Trump is reordering the terrain? Could the U.S. be now playing a position going forward that is different because of Trump's sort of blundering into, say, the conflagration with Iran and the way that it may reorder some of the power relationships? Because historically, as you say, the US has militarily been the kind of guarantor of the protection of countries in the Gulf and elsewhere. And now it's questionable whether the US can play that role anymore. Do you think Trump is upending the longstanding centrality and stability of the US within the global capitalist system?
What's clear, I think, is that Trump has done very real damage to the credibility of the US and has certainly, not just because of blundering into the war in Iran, which has been, I think, quite damaging for US power in the Middle East, although one has to balance that assessment against the reality that, in effect, what has gone on in the Middle East, has more or less been the realization of the neocon dream since at least the 2000s. I mean, the attack on Iran seems to have backfired very significantly, although maybe not as significantly as some seem to believe, but clearly it's a blunder that is going to create huge problems for the US strategically in the region. But I mean, they have, effectively significantly weakened Hezbollah. They have, taken out the Syrian regime. They've committed a genocide against the Palestinians, which was long considered a red line, the red line of red lines in Middle East politics, since at least the days of Nasser and Arab nationalism and so on. So the remaking of the Middle East has been very, very significant, and they've systematically, militarily crushed a huge range of U.S.-Israeli foes in the region. Despite the problems with doing so in the case of Iran, which is a much more powerful and much more significant actor than Syria or Lebanon is, but so that one has to balance the disaster in Iran against those other realities. But I do think that the Iran war has been a huge problem for them and will continue to be so in the future. I mean, at this point, the most they can hope for is a return to the JCPOA, which was the agreement that Trump ripped up that Obama had reached with the Iranians prior to his presidency in 2016. So yeah, I think that the Iran war is a huge disaster, and I think even apart from that, Trump waging tariff wars against close allies, his threats to pull out of NATO, his threats to invade Denmark, the country that is responsible for governing Greenland, which Trump has threatened to use military force in order to seize. I mean, all these things have led to a very significant level of disarray in the American imperial bloc, and the mechanisms of coordination across advanced capitalist states that is the foundation of this kind of condominium of states that is the structural basis of American empire. There's a huge amount of disarray that has been introduced in those relationships, and therefore, even more broadly among relationships, between the American state and others that are less wealthy and less central to the global capitalist system, as well. And so I think it's very likely that not just Europe, but also other states in the semi-periphery and periphery are eagerly looking for any alternative or beginning to think through what an alternative to the dollar system might look like. The problem is just that all of those efforts at this point are quite a long ways off. I mean, the yuan is tightly controlled. Chinese financial markets are tightly controlled by the Chinese state. There's just not enough liquidity in those markets due to the nature of the political control that the Chinese state exerts over financial markets in China to allow that currency to function in the kind of global way that the US dollar does. Similar, at least as of now. I mean, its reserve holdings of renminbi are growing. It's entirely possible that will continue to happen at the margins, but the dollar share still remains overwhelmingly dominant. The same could be said of the euro. I mean, for all of Europe's frustration and even fear, I think, of what Trump may do and has done, Europe doesn't really have a plan B. They have nowhere to go, but continued reliance on the US militarily and economically in the world system. I mean, they may make some movements over the long run toward greater independence, but it's very hard to imagine anything significant happening in the near term. Similarly with Russia, right? Russia is a relatively small economy. It's about the size of California's economy. The idea that Russia is going to play the kind of global role that the US has done, I think, is very, very far-fetched. And as I mentioned earlier, I think the BRICS, they don't represent any kind of alternative, at least as of now. I mean, even in the event that they do initiate some kind of project to replace the dollar system, I think that's extremely hard to imagine it being successful and is quite a long ways off, given the fact that that block of states has very little political coherence or economic coherence, lacking, for example, a central bank. So for now, I think the issue is more, Trump has rattled the foundations of the American empire. He has sharply increased the delegitimation of American power internationally and weakened the hegemonic nature of American power, meaning the consent-based element of American power. But the material and structural economic foundations of the global role of the US, remain present. And I think it's safe to say at this point that the American state remains the indispensable center of global accumulation, whether we like that or not. And I think it's definitely the case that the other capitalist states, even wealthy and powerful capitalist states, are less and less inclined to find that acceptable and maybe are increasingly worried about the erratic nature of American politics. But there's just no alternative. So for now, I think, people are kind of just holding their breath that Trump goes and everything can return to normal. Now that's yet another issue, and whether that's possible or what that would even mean, I think, is a different question. But that is where we are.
Well, how do you understand what Trump has done, with his upending of the existing order in global trade, this mantra of America First, although what America First actually looks like in practice is complicated. Can we just say that it is incoherent? I mean, often Trump's actions are attributed to psychological instability, but at the same time, of course, Trump rose with a cohort of other far-right leaders around the world. So it wasn't just one crazy person getting elected, yet again. How do you understand Trump's agenda?
There's a question, I think, of how ideologically committed Trump is, and if so, to what. What he really has is a political instinct that has served him very well in terms of being able to ride this wave of populist resentment into the White House now for a second time. And he built this his political his political coalition based on bringing together resentment at globalization and the cost of globalization and the cost of empire for the working class, for the lumpen proletariat, for small business and the petty bourgeoisie, especially in the wake of the 2008 crisis. He was able to pull together this coalition by bringing together resentment at globalization with anti-immigrant politics and nationalism and all the rest of it. And I think we've been watching him run into one brick wall after the next. And remarkably, despite the fact that that has been the case, he has been able to continue to move forward and to continue to maneuver in such a way that he hasn't been able to be fully stopped. And capital has largely chosen to kind of adopt a wait and see attitude by and large, give him some space, give his trade, revision of the global trade efforts, some space, give his anti-immigrant politics some space, give his, severe erosion of democratic rights and civil liberties at home some space and see what happens. The one red line they seem to have put in place, by the way, is around the independence of the Federal Reserve. So it seems to be that that the basic logic is they can absorb any costs. They're not happy about tariffs, but they can work with it. They can absorb it. They'll push against it, but as long as you don't screw with the power of the banks and the independence of the Federal Reserve, they'll kind of take it on the chin for now, especially if they're rewarded with tax breaks and everything else. So I think Trump, his immigration stuff, I think, has run into a brick wall. His trade stuff, I think, has run into a brick wall. I think the tariffs didn't work. I think they're a complete failure. And by and large, he's had to back down in all the crucial areas with regard to imposing tariffs on allies or even on China. And I think what we have seen is effectively a rogue president who is attempting to hold together his domestic coalition by balancing an attempt to appease capital with an attempt to rebalance, readjust the costs and benefits of empire. And I think the main tool that he was trying to use to do that was tariffs and the immigration crackdown, but also, but especially tariffs. And he thought, I think, that he could use tariffs to readjust how the costs of empire are distributed, to raise the cost a bit to capital, and to increase, to alleviate some of the costs on the working class and the lumpen proletariat at home through restructuring the terms of international trade by imposing tariffs. And I think that's been a colossal, unmitigated failure. It did not have the impact that he expected. And precisely because he's had to accommodate the ongoing strength of capital, I think he has had to back down on all the critical areas in which he was hoping he could use tariffs as a lever to change the distribution of costs at home of U.S. imperialism.
Of course, the recent news was of the electoral defeat of Viktor Orban, the Hungarian strongman. Orban, in many ways, was a model for the Trump administration. And Trump rose along with other hard right leaders in a kind of wave across the world of backlash after the global financial crisis and the way that austerity affected people in many different countries. How would you assess that whole wave of hard right governments, looking at them internationally? Number one, how much do you feel like they had a common agenda, and to what degree has that been successful beyond the borders of the United States?
Yeah, I mean that's really a critical question. I think it's kind of the jury's still out. I mean, there is a kind of, neo-fascist international. And what's interesting is that, Trump's, national security strategy actually explicitly aims to support these hard right nationalist forces all across Europe. And it's been a foreign policy objective of the United States to kind of remake the international system, international, especially the most within the most powerful countries, around these kind of hard right nationalist and anti-immigrant forces, and to kind of restore the ethno-national purity of European states. And I think the jury's out on, how much coordination and how much mutual support and camaraderie existed among these different forces. Clearly, they came to power, as you say, around the same time, and they were responding to the very same contradictions of globalization that Trump was responding to. And that catapulted all of these forces to power through somewhat similar means. But I think one has to admit that, as in the case of Trump, the balance, of these forces in terms of their successes and their failures has tilted pretty significantly toward the limits of their ability to really transform their societies and global capitalism. One could begin with Brexit. I mean, what was really the outcome of the British withdrawal from the EU? Immediately, liberal forces in the British state and capitalist class immediately started renegotiating all of the necessary economic measures to sustain effectively the status quo to the extent that it's feasible. Giorgia Meloni, of course, now in a feud with Trump over Trump's bizarre war that he's chosen to start with the Pope.
Of Italy, yeah.
Yeah, Giorgia Meloni of Italy, exactly. What somebody who Trump has embraced, publicly and expressed support for. Her politics in Italy have again run up against the same kinds of barriers that are set by the capitalist system, right? Viktor Orban, now the most recent example of somebody who was just rejected massively by a popular mandate, the same kind of rejection that one would expect the Republicans are going to be facing in the US in the midterms. So what's interesting, I think, about the experience of the far right forces across Europe is that the same unwillingness of big capital to enter into the kind of social democratic compromises that might extend additional benefits or rebalance the costs and benefits of capitalism by extending some support or income redistribution to the working class on the basis of social democratic politics, those same barriers are also applicable to the right-wing forces. So they are just as unable to negotiate a readjustment of the terms of global capitalism with an empowered capitalist class that is globally integrated as social democratic forces are. So whether you call it, you know, national socialism or the version in the US led by people like Joshua Hawley, national conservatism, which is, you know, basically just national socialism, or other, in other terms, Nazism, where, you know, the Strasserite version of it, I should say, which was basically the version of Nazism that aims to use Nazi ideology to extend social democratic type class compromise bargains to the ethnically right sections of the working class, namely the white ones. Those projects are just as limited and just as impossible to achieve in relation to a capitalist class that is unwilling to make compromises, which is the actual structural foundation of the impasse that social democratic politics has faced. Right? In order to engage in social democratic class bargains, you need part of capital to be willing to bargain with you. And in the context of the post-1970s restructuring of the American empire, there's no part of capital that's willing to enter into those kind of distributional bargains. They can just as easily exit and invest elsewhere rather than be forced into these kinds of concessions with domestic workers. So regardless of the ideological makeup of these demands for compromises, and regardless of the racial makeup of those who are seeking those compromises, capital is just as happy to take advantage of those ideologies insofar as that it can benefit from them, and then firmly put the brakes on this going further than what they are willing to accept. And I think it's just interesting to see the same barriers coming up on the right and the left. Now, of course, the key question is, under what conditions would a section of big capital become willing to entertain a kind of compromise with the far right forces that we're discussing? And I think under such a condition, those forces would be separated from key elements of their base that until now have been critical for propelling those forces into power, namely the petty bourgeoisie, sections of small capital, the lumpen proletariat, sections of the working class. Those forces would have to be separated from those elements of their base, attached to representational ties with big capital, and the ideology of national populism that they've espoused would have to be rearranged so as to serve the continuation of the status quo. Albeit under a new kind of ideological legitimation. And so that's what's most dangerous. But what's becoming clear is that doesn't exactly seem to be on the horizon at this moment.
And are you saying under those circumstances, any sort of kind of nodding toward redistribution of some kind would be just chucked?
Yeah, I mean, most likely, as happened in the case of the Nazis, right? The Strasser brothers, who were basically the working class wing of Nazism, National Socialism, were killed. And that part of Nazi politics was destroyed prior to the Nazis developing the alliance of big capital that, you know, ultimately enabled them to govern insofar as they were able to govern in a stable fashion. But, even in that case, you know, you see the continuation of crisis just as much as the alleviation of crisis through the period of the Nazis being in power. So it's not like even if the far right and capital make some kind of a bargain, the crisis ends. In some ways, that accelerates the political crisis and intensifies it as a condition for those forces being able to sustain themselves in power. But what you would expect to see is a constant back and forth, right? A constant incoherent, contradictory back and forth between making some gestures toward, you know, the petty bourgeoisie through some measures that the petty bourgeoisie seeks or would like to see happen, as well as workers, and then ultimately reversing those and you know, implementing policies that fundamentally attack workers and the petty bourgeoisie, like what we've seen with Trump's attempts to roll back healthcare, attacks on social programs, really accelerating the very austerity measures that the reaction to which brought him to power in the first place. So everywhere we see the far right coming to power in capitalist states, this is the kind of contradictory back and forth that we see, attempting to appease capital on the one hand, then attempting to appease other parts of their base, the petty bourgeoisie and the working class, on the other hand, even though these two forces, these two components of the social base of far-right politics are fundamentally incompatible and irreconcilable. So these far-right forces are kind of caught in the middle. And the problem that Trump has faced, like these other people we're mentioning, is that he's faced with a capitalist class that remains very, very powerful and is unwilling to compromise beyond a very certain limited boundary unless compelled to. And Trump, of course, it does not have the kind of organized mass base that would compel capital to do anything it doesn't really want to do. So the most he's been able to do is kind of cause chaos. And do things like the tariffs that then he's forced to climb down from after a short period of time. So as of now, it seems unlikely that any significant part of capital is entertaining forming an alliance with MAGA, just as in these other cases. But we just are seeing news that apparently the Amok current that maintains climate stability to a certain extent in the East Coast of the U.S. as well as in Europe is breaking down. That's going to have very significant impacts on the climate, the kinds of weather patterns that we experience in the U.S. and Europe, with some significant effects on food supplies and so on. And in the event that, well, as we know, it inevitably will, this crisis continues to accelerate in ecological terms, the kinds of things that become possible in the very, very frightening future that is in store for us. The political calculus is quite different, and there's no telling where this goes or what capital may find to be in its interest as the world changes.
Stephen Marr, certainly liberals hope that the clock can be turned back, right? That, if the US has fair elections, manages to have fair elections, and, Trump goes off into the sunset after 2028, that we'll return to the world that we had before his second term. I wanted to ask you, how realistic is that? And including for, the Orbans and so on, as they leave power, their brand of far-right politics was one that went through the liberal democratic state. Obviously, they came to power in elections, and they were able to remake those liberal democratic structures. So, what is the staying power, do you think, of those transformations?
I think definitely it's the case that there's no going back from Trump. Things are fundamentally different, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle. Partly that's because of the shift in political culture. What's going to happen to the Republican Party in the absence of Trump? Will this MAGA, populist, neo-fascist political milieu that's been cultivated now within the Republican Party, will that just go away? I kind of doubt it, right? And who's going to be the successor to Trump? That becomes a very real question. It could be somebody even scarier than Trump. It could be somebody more effective than Trump. So I think that's one issue. Another issue is the actual remaking of the state that's gone on. And I think what Trump, especially those around him, have very explicitly been about from the very beginning is changing the way the state works, changing the way governance happens in the United States, politicizing the military, trying their hardest to push forward as much as they can the domestic role of the military in maintaining order and in an explicitly political fashion. So that their allegiance is much more closely and directly linked to the personal power of this charismatic leader, Donald Trump. The tremendous expansion of ICE within the state, such that it almost could be seen as forming potentially a substitute for the lack of a kind of brown shirt movement of street fighters that has been characteristic of fascist movements in the 20th century. Trump famously lacked that. But ICE could well evolve into that. And if it's not Trump, it could be somebody else. But I am not at all comfortable to say that we're not going to see things like ICE surrounding polling stations in the midterms or trying to intimidate voters or and in certain ways they are setting the stage to try to draw into question the outcomes of the midterm and later presidential elections. Now, it seems that the SAVE Act is not going to work. The SAVE Act, of course, being the measure that they were trying to ram through Congress that would basically fundamentally change the way American elections work, including by allowing private organizations to sue election officials who are seen to potentially be having authorized or allowed illegal immigrants to vote. Now, of course, the discourse around illegal immigration also points to the possibility of ICE, checking immigration status at polling places and all the rest of it. All, of course, aimed at intimidating immigrants. But also, that act would have disenfranchised millions of Americans, including women and students and people who have moved recently. I mean, a very large-scale disenfranchisement that failed. But I'm not at all content that there's not going to be other attempts to act similarly. And there's also no question that elections in general in this country, Trump has done a lot to delegitimate them. And of course, he's very well aware that what he's saying is fully made up. But there's a conscious political project that is backed by at least some elites and certainly ideological and political forces in and around the Republican Party to fundamentally delegitimate elections as the basis for legitimate political power in the United States. And that's a project that I doubt ends with Trump. Not only in the sense that these individuals who are pushing it are going to remain in the state, but that the lasting effects of what's already been said and done is not going to be able to be just wiped away. And there's now a situation in which opportunist politicians up and down the American state structure, from state level and local level elections all the way up to national elections, can take advantage of this discrediting of the electoral process in order to advance their own political aspirations. With that issue in particular, the future of just elections, as narrow as they are, as the basis for rotation in power among two political parties, is increasingly in crisis. I mean, the whole basis of representative democracy is that everybody has to accept the rules of the game, right? Yes, your party may lose the election, but that's okay because you believe that the elections are fair and you may get back into power next time. And so there's no existential threat posed by the fact that the other party is going to be gaining power. Well, that is breaking down very directly and very clearly. And I think both sides, the Democrats and Republicans, increasingly see elections as something that will potentially have existential consequences, not just for their own political organization, but for the way the state functions. And that includes all the stuff we've been talking about, the role of ICE, the purging of the military by Pete Hegseth and its growing political role, the politicization of the intelligence agencies, the politicization of the courts. We just saw a Supreme Court justice give a speech at which he bashed progressivism as fundamentally antithetical to the Declaration of Independence and its values. All of this is happening in a way that is not going to just come to an end with the departure of one individual from the political scene. And so I think there's a need to advance an alternative that is much more substantial than a return to the neoliberal status quo ante. And the biggest threat we in fact face right now is that Trump leaves, the Democrats get back in power, and the left and everybody else breathes a sigh of relief and says, okay, now everything's back to normal. Neoliberalism and globalization will restabilize and everything's going to be okay. I think that is a very, very dangerous illusion that the left should actively now already be trying to work against and building the capacity to put forward a genuine alternative.
Well, let me ask you about that. So, on the one hand, you've been painting a picture in which Trump has failed in many ways in much of his agenda, and of course, getting a significant part of the capitalist class kind of on board with his agenda. At the same time, you've also described a kind of remaking of the instruments of the state in ways that are going to be lasting after he is gone. And so then this brings us to the question of, what should the left be organizing for beyond what you've just said, which is not being quiescent about going back to the status quo and, hoping everything will be fine then. Obviously, as you and many other commentators on the left have argued, the Democratic Party paved the way for the rise of Trump. And then you have, of course, the emergence in recent years of a social democratic left that is hoping for something further to the left than the Democratic Party. But you also mentioned earlier that not only has significant sections of the capitalist class not wanted to ally itself, at least for now, with the hard right, they also aren't interested in allying themselves with the left. And, many people on the left would say, okay, well, why should we care? But for the agenda of social democracy, historically, that has been, has it not, been about an alliance between sections of the working class and sections of the business class?
Yeah, exactly. That so social democracy, I mean, what sets it apart from socialism as a kind of political strategy and political ideology is that social democracy effectively is oriented around trying to build an alliance with a section of capital that it sees as progressive or at least open to redistributing income, expanding some social programs for workers, willing to enter into a kind of class distributional bargain. And so social democrats are effectively interested in pursuing a better deal for workers within capitalism without challenging private control of investment or capitalist control over the means of production. And unfortunately, in the current moment, that politics, since the 1970s crisis, has reached an impasse. Not because there's not structural space for redistribution. I mean, you have record profits, you have huge amounts of inequality. That means that there is structural space for redistributive policy. The problem is, no part of capital can be compelled to enter into these kinds of distributional bargains because of the way the US empire has been restructured since the 1970s. Namely, free capital mobility cost-free. If capital can just circulate investment anywhere in the world, effectively cost-free, wherever regulatory and labor costs are the cheapest, there's no real incentive for them to be compelled to enter into these kind of bargains with workers at home. So what that means in my mind is that workers are effectively faced with what Sam Gindin sometimes calls the polarization of options since the 1970s crisis, which is to say that there is no middle, nice, win-win Keynesian social democratic compromise, which isn't to say that there's no possibility for reform. Reform is possible, but those reforms have to be seen as a vehicle toward pushing further. If reform is possible, the return of the Keynesian welfare state as a stable kind of form in the world market is not. So we can't imagine that we can just return to the kind of post-war class compromise that comprised the social democratic regimes of Europe and the New Deal to a much more limited extent in the US. We have to see the struggle for reform as something that is going to mean fighting against the entire capitalist class, both finance and industry. Financialization has enhanced the competitiveness and profitability of industrial capital, just as the tech companies have enhanced the dynamism and competitiveness of industrial capital. So what this means is that the struggle for reform is going to take the form of a struggle against the entirety of the capitalist class. And it's going to mean ultimately organizing people to take capital away from capital, to start making some inroads towards expanding popular control over investment.
Stephen Marr, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I've been speaking with Stephen Marr. He's co-editor of The Socialist Register. The latest issue is titled Late Stage Capitalism? You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.